Barbering is one of the oldest professions available to African Americans in this country, but black barbershops and their barbers have played a controversial role in American history, dividing members of their communities long before they united them and became not just businesses, but informal community centers or men's clubs. When Quincy T. Mills, a professor of history at Vassar, couldn't find a book on the history of black barbershops, he set out to write one himself, and the result is Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America. It's published by University of Pennsylvania Press. I'm very pleased that it has brought Professor Mills to our show today. Hello.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
While you were researching this book, you had trouble getting black barbers to speak to you.
No.
I thought black barbers speak to everybody.
Well, not those with very long dreadlocks. So I had very long dreadlocks that came down to my waist, and I went south looking for barbers who had owned or worked in a barbershop any time before the 1970s. And I wasn't surprised that they had jokes about my very long hair, but I was surprised that they were hesitant to talk to me about the history of barbering. Essentially, they said, how does it look that you want to talk to me about barbering and you haven't cut your hair in I don't know how long? Another barber said, I'm in the grooming business and you don't look groomed. Ultimately, these barbers they saw me as a threat to their livelihoods.
They must have hated afros as well.
Oh, they despised afros in many ways, because many of them said that afros darn near nearly put them out of business. And so with all the politics of black power, of black consciousness, and indeed blackness surrounding the barbershop itself, those barbers were concerned about their financial accounts being in the black.
Let's go back to the 19th century. You write that James Thomas, the first black man to achieve both freedom and residency in Nashville, owned a barbershop. When was that?
Yeah, so this was the 1850s, and Thomas was a very – James Thomas, very interesting figure. He wrote an autobiography about his life as a barber in Tennessee and St. Louis. But he sort of – had this complicated relationship with his white patrons, like all black barbers in the antebellum period. Essentially, these barbers were independent. In some cases, they were free. In other cases, they were quasi-free, right? So they were not enslaved per se, but some person, some benefactor did own them, because many states, once an African-American had gained their freedom, they were forced to leave the state, and so many African Americans who were on the verge of getting their freedom would sort of stop just short of that so they could remain close to family members. But again, and indeed, many African Americans owned their family members, quote unquote, as slaves, but they owned them because they didn't want them to have to leave the state.
But we're talking during the period of slavery. These are African Americans whose clientele were white. It's kind of like black waiters.
Absolutely, right. And so we certainly shouldn't.
There could be a movie called The Barber instead of The Butler, couldn't there?
There really could be. There really could be. And indeed, there were many barbers who had shaved future presidents, right? So in Springfield, Abraham Lincoln's barber was William Florville before he moved on to D.C. William McKinley, before he moved on to D.C., his barber was George Myers. And certainly we know that Barack
we'll get
Obama's
to George Myers
barber,
in a little
right?
bit.
Absolutely.
Well, what were some of the difficulties that these barbers faced? I can't imagine their lives were all that easy, especially since they were working in many cases within an area that where slavery was in force.
Certainly. So one of their major challenges was that they had to negotiate the politics of their barbershop. So these black barbers shaving white men, shaving plantation slave owners, shaving white businessmen, politicians, they had very little control over their shops in a way. And so these white patrons decided that they did not want to be shaved next to a black man being shaved. And so black men could not come into these barbershops to be shaved.
These were segregated barbershops.
They were segregated barbershops, but segregated not by the black barber, I'd argue, but by those white patrons.
So what happened when a black customer came in and said, I want a haircut?
A barber would say, I'm sorry, but we don't shave colored folk here.
Now, was this true in the North as well?
This was true in the North as well.
But the barbers in the North must have felt a little freer. Any of them work in the abolitionist movement?
Many of them worked in the anti-slavery movement. In fact, they were uniquely situated because if we take the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, barbers would often barbers along with hotel waiters, restaurant waiters, black, who again dominated the service industry. Whenever a slave catcher or a master would travel north, they would stay in a hotel, they would eat at a restaurant, and most likely they would go to a barbershop. And so between these networks, these barbers would say, there's a slave catcher that's here from Kentucky looking for this particular person. You better get on going because he's looking for you, right? And so, but there were also barbers who would open up their shop doors overnight, right, to hide fugitives who were moving from point A to point B.
How did Frederick Douglass, who's mentioned frequently in this book, view black barbers? I mean, here's a man who wore his hair long and either had a beard or a goatee, so I imagine he didn't go to barbers very often.
Yeah, Douglass despised the fact that particularly black barbers in the North had not shed these kinds of occupations that were seen as unmanly and unskilled. So for Douglass, his critiques of barbers were not so much of barbers in the South, because he believed that, well, they're in slave society so that they don't have much of a choice. But he believed that in the North, essentially in freedom, African-Americans should take up the mechanical trades that were seen as much more manly and much more skilled. And so he wrote extensively in his newspaper about the unmanly position of barbers. Now, the problem is that Frederick Douglass advocated the expansion of a black middle class. Well, these barbers were key figures of that black middle class Douglass wanted to actually see.
In fact, this was an entree into entrepreneurship.
Absolutely. Black barbers were quite wealthy, grooming white men, and that was certainly a trade-off that they had to deal with. Nonetheless, I argue in the book that these barbers were not divorced from black communities, right? So again, they were influential in the anti-slavery movement. They were influential in the development of black communities over time.
My guest is Quincy T. Mills, who's a professor of history at Vassar College. His book, Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and the Barbershops in America. Well, after the Civil War, did the barbers continue to cater only to white clientele?
Of course, because that was their clientele before the Civil War, right? So there was a deep continuation, right? But certainly by the 1890s, a new generation of African Americans entered barbering. This was a generation that was born after the Civil War. They were not as connected to white communities as their predecessors were. They wanted to open barbershops in black communities. And this is certainly the time that Jim Crow segregation is on the rise. And so it's not until the 1890s that we see black-owned and black-patronized commercial barbershops emerging in American cities.
And you describe how barbers navigated Jim Crow segregation in ways that were fairly sophisticated, also politically and culturally sophisticated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. So I think in many ways, these barbers sort of, again, so think about barbershops as commercial spaces, right? But barbers as leaders within black communities. And so, again, they used the resources from their shops, whether political resources or economic resources, to engage with black communities.
Zora Neale Hurston wrote about witnessing racial tensions when she worked as a manicurist in Washington, D.C. during the summer of 1918. Well, Washington, D.C., of course, was a rather ambivalent city. It's both North and South.
That's right. That's right. And certainly she was a student at Howard, and she was earning money in George Robinson's barbershop to pay for her college education. And what's interesting is that certainly we don't usually think about women in barbershops, but women have always been in barbershops as barbers, as manicurists, and certainly as customers. And Hurston was a manicurist there in Robinson's barbershop. And this barbershop only served white men in 1918. But he also had a barbershop in the Shaw District of D.C. that served black customers.
And what did she write about?
Well, she wrote about this particular incident where an African-American wanted to get a haircut in George Robinson's barbershop. But the barber said, no, we don't shave colored folk here. You have to go down to Robinson's shop in Shaw. But Zora Neale Hurston wanted this customer thrown out. And this customer was eventually thrown out by the black barbers and the white patrons. Hurston wanted this customer thrown out in many ways because this was a threat to her livelihood. She saw this customer, this black customer, in a way attempting to sort of break up what was helping her essentially pay her college tuition. And so she was quite ambivalent about the situation because she realized in some ways she was giving sanction to Jim Crow, but at the same time, she had to be concerned about her individual interests.
And it wasn't until many years later, as you point out, black college students entered white barbershops for haircuts just as they entered lunch counters for hamburgers during the years of civil rights activism.
Certainly. During the civil rights movement, many black students, when they went off to college and to colleges that were in rural towns, certainly as I think any college student, black college student today, the first thing that they want to know is, where am I going to get my hair cut? And many of those college students didn't want to take this sort of long sojourn to a black barbershop that might have been 5 or 6 or 10 miles away. And so they wanted to go into the white shop just to get a haircut, but they were rebuffed.
Now, you mentioned George Myers. He became very rich. He ran a whole chain of barbershops. But I was wondering about somebody who would like to open up a shop. It must have been hard to get a loan. Then laws started coming in about licensing and sanitation. And I suspect that it wasn't so easy. And then, of course, white barbers came along as well, especially immigrant barbers. So did this change everything for the black barbershops? Is that when they started catering to the black community?
So quite the contrary. There were very low barriers to entry to opening a barbershop. Once you get a space, you pay the lease, you get a couple chairs, you get your equipment, and you're good to go. And so getting a loan was that most folks didn't get a loan to open a barbershop. Again, they just sort of opened very small shops, maybe two or a three-chair shop. But certainly once the Journeyman Barbers Union of America was formed in 1887, and primarily by German immigrants, let's certainly first keep in mind that native whites didn't want to be barbers because they associated barbering with sort of slave labor, servile labor, unskilled work, which was beneath them, so to speak. So German immigrants formed the Barbers Union, and they wanted to essentially reskill barbering. They wanted to add this sense of exclusivity to what it meant to be a barber, and for that they wanted to sort of be sure that folks were going to a barber college. They were learning the anatomy of the body, right? Think about the sort of old barber surgeon days, right? They wanted to sort of, again, instill this sense of exclusivity to what it meant to be a barber. And so they lobbied for state licensing laws across the country. In many states, they were quite successful. In other states, it took a long time to get these laws passed.
When did black barbershops start becoming informal meeting places for African-American men?
This is certainly roughly around the Great Migration, the Great Depression, certainly through the Second World War. So in the South, when African-Americans were contemplating the move north, we know that the Chicago Defender, for example, was a major national newspaper that talked about the migration, that talked about jobs north, and that encouraged black Southerners to move north. The Chicago Defender, along with other black newspapers, were sewed and read in black barbershops. And so African Americans would sit in barbershops and talk about the idea of moving north, talk about the availability of jobs, talk about where to live. Once they certainly did get on the train and head north. Once they got off the train, they were looking for, in many cases, a place to live, a place to work, in some cases a place to worship, and indeed a place to get a haircut. And indeed, getting into these barbershops, they could tap into a larger community network, right, where the barber would know, would suggest, go check out this church, go check out this job, and go check out this apartment building where you might find a place to stay.
Now, they also were places of political debate. Do they remain such?
They definitely remain such. I think it's not so much exciting or new that a group of people who are sitting in a small space talk or engage. That's not really innovative, right? We certainly expect that. But what's really critical is that during the rise of Jim Crow, where they had very few spaces, few public spaces to engage and talk without the surveillance of a larger white public, that's when barbershops where black churches become central to how African Americans understood their worldviews and understood their politics.
Quincy T. Mills will be reading at the Brooklyn Public Library this Sunday at 1 p.m. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book, Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America, is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press and has fabulous photographs, by the way.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
I appreciate it.